One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Forward now. Welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. I am delighted to invite back to the podcast Damien Lewis. He's one of the small number of historians and authors that we've been lucky to have a second visit from. Damien's new title, Forged in Hell, another of his histories of the SAS, focuses on the SAS during the Italian campaign from the torch landings onwards. And so that's going to be really the focus of our conversation today. But firstly, welcome again, Damien.
Thank you. Great to be back. Always good.
Yeah. So previously, when we talked about the SAS, we talked about the war in the desert in North Africa, and probably people that have any knowledge of the SAS during the Second World War, that's the kind of thing they would point to, you know, the Long Range Desert Group and things like that. But from the Forged in Hell, the importance of the SAS in Italy, I had very little knowledge of that, and it really kind of struck out to me as this is a thing that's been completely overlooked. Perhaps you can tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, it's almost completely unknown and unheard of. It's almost as if, you know, certainly in the public imagination, and I think in most published sources, the SAS go from, you know, North Africa and 18 months of waging war in the desert almost directly to D-Day, the post-D-Day operations. Of course, that's not what happened at all. You know, the reality is that, you know, come February, March 1943, with David Stirling's capture, the founder of the SAS being captured by Rommel's troops, you know, the SAS's fortunes looked very grim indeed. And there was, again, another attempt to disband them, you know, branded raiders of the thug variety, attempts made to write them out of existence, claiming that, you know, now the war was turning towards Europe, with North Africa largely being won. There was no role for such a maverick piratical force, which was fine in the open deserts, but not fine for Europe, where it'd be a more gentlemanly form of warfare. That was the argument used. And of course, it fell to then Major Blair Paddy Mayne, who was one of, obviously, David Stirling's, you know, stalwart deputies, to try to grasp that nettle, because somebody had to step forward and take command, and it fell on his shoulders. Many believed he was not the right individual, because although being a superlative, peerless raider and leader of men and inspirer of men, many thought he did not have what it took to fight the battles on high with the British hierarchy, and he proved them wrong.
They thought he couldn't do politics, in essence.
Yeah, they thought he couldn't, you know, operate in the corridors of power. He was you know, Maine didn't hide his dislike of those he took against. And he took against those in positions of power or rank we thought didn't deserve those positions of power or rank. He couldn't hide that. Equally, he made instant decisions about individuals that he met, you know, who were stepping forward to join the SAS, and he made those decisions in a flash.
Mm-hmm. So he's a guy that goes kind of, you know, when people are joining the SAS particularly, he goes on instinct, he goes on his gut, and he says,
you're corridors of power.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then you're either our kind of guy or not.
Absolutely.
So one thing I've often wondered, because, you know, there's this story, isn't there, that kind of the special forces are sort of kind of something that pops from Churchill's imagination in about 1940. And it's one of those things that, because it sounds like a good story, I always wonder about it. And one of the things I guess I wonder is, you know, as the war dragged on, you know, how much interest did Churchill maintain in people like Paddy Maine and David Stirling?
Yeah, no, the idea that special forces originated, can you hear me?
Oh, yes, I can hear you fine, yes.
Hello? Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So the idea that special forces originated, you know, with Churchill's call to arms in June 1940 is largely correct. I mean, it's absolutely true that he's the, you know, Colonel Dudley Clark came to him with his back of an envelope idea for the commandos, and Churchill, you know, the British commandos, and Churchill grabbed it with both hands because he believed, even at that moment, our darkest hour, amazingly, wonderfully, he believed that attack was the best form of defence. He believed we had to go on the offensive. And although these kind of raids, you could argue, certainly back then in June, in the summer of 1940, in the autumn of 1940, were but pinpricks in the greater scheme of the war, they weren't, because as Churchill understood innately, instinctively, they were massive fillips to the morale of the British people when they hit the headlines, and they gave us the conviction that we could fight. And Churchill always had a view towards America and Roosevelt. And every time there was headlines in the British papers lauding these commando and special forces operations, they were repeated in America. So it was very effective.
Mm-hmm. And because at the Casablanca conference in 1943, that's where the Americans are sort of persuaded by the British, probably for the last time, that, you know, the British are, you know, take the lead on strategy. And there's misgivings about the Mediterranean strategy, and there's misgivings about Italy. And I think there are certain, you know, I think Churchill was thinking of going further eastwards into the Greek islands and things like that, but that doesn't happen. So Italy is kind of Churchill's pet project. And do you think that at the time, you know, he was considering that the special forces would be integral to that, or is his thinking not on that kind of level?
Yeah, no, the soft underbelly of Europe, you know, the landings from North Africa into Italy, southern Italy, this was Churchill's great project. It was driven by Stalin's demand that the Allies open the second front in Europe, mm-hmm, to support the Russians, who were getting, you know, paced, you know, fighting with great courage, but getting, you know, pushed back. And so Churchill argued, and Roosevelt bought that argument, that they should open the second front in the soft underbelly of Europe, southern Italy. And yeah, there are actually documents in which Churchill writes about the fact that there will need to be, you know, a vanguard of landing forces who are, you know, airborne and seaborne commandos and special forces to act as the tip of the spear. And that's exactly the role that the SAS are given in kind of March 1943, when Paddy Maine is arguing the SAS still have a role in Europe, and there is something they can do.
Sure. And so coming to Italy, this idea of this has often been said, the idea of the soft underbelly of Europe, it is a complete myth, and the Italian campaign is long and hard and arduous. But you write about some kind of almost unbelievable landing operations to take out naval guns, which I think was later the inspiration for the novel and the film The Guns of Navarone. But perhaps you can tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so it is completely wrong to view Italy as the easy option. And, it, you know, the epithet that was given those who fought there, the D-Day dodgers, is wholly unjustified and unjust. I mean, what actually happened in Italy? Yes, initially the Italians surrendered quite quickly, but that made not a jot of difference, because all that happened instead was Hitler vowed that Italy would not fall and sent some of his best troops, some of his best armoured divisions, some of his best mountain troops to Italy to hold it at all costs. So it was a long, hard-fought campaign. And bear in mind, we were still fighting to win Italy when our own forces were marching across the borders of the fatherland in the north from France and actually taking Germany. So that shows you how hard-fought it was. And the SAS's role from the very word go, which was to serve as the vanguard of the Operation Husky landings, the invasion of Italy, which at that stage was the largest invasion fleet ever assembled. And, you know, a little shy of 500,000 men at arms, you know, their role, which was to take out these massive shore guns, which were immune to air attack because they were encased in thick concrete, was a total mission impossible. You could argue, and I think a lot of them thought it was a suicide mission, because, you know, they had to go in these assault landing craft, these very thinly armored landing craft, right under the barrels of the very guns, so obviously asking to get blown out of the water, to do so at night, then to scale impossible cliffs, carrying impossible loads, including 81mm mortars and mortar shells, and then assault these heavily defended, barbed wire encased, machine gun nest surrounded gun emplacements when they knew they were going to be outnumbered 50-1.
Mm-hmm.
And if they didn't pull it off within a matter of hours, i.e. during the hours of darkness, come sun up, the guns would open up and the invasion fleet would get blown out of the water. So this was a do-or-die mission impossible writ large, absolutely.
How on earth did they manage to do it?
Well, it got worse. Before it got anything like better, it got infinitely worse, because, you know, sailing across the Mediterranean in July 1943, you can be forgiven for imagining you will experience a flat, sunny calm. Why not? And all the assault planners imagined that was the case, including, indeed, the German opposite number, General Kurt Student, the head of their airborne forces, who had game-planned how the Allies might invade and said probably Sicily, probably southern Sicily, but there'll be nothing to worry about in terms of the weather because it's always a flat calm. Well, lo and behold, the invasion fleet hoves into sight of Sicily. They can see Mount Etna, and a terrible storm blows up. It is howling, blowing a hooli. And as these ships go on to invasion lighting, Mayne calls a meeting of his officers and basically says to them, words to the effect, I don't know if the wee little boats will live in the water, meaning will we even get ashore? So there's that terrible moment, you know, and it's very poignant, where he really alone has to make that decision. Do we go and risk getting dashed to pieces, you know, and swamped in the seas, or do we not go and risk the whole invasion fleet and getting blown out of the water? Well, I mean, there is really only one decision he can make, and he obviously makes the decision, they go. And so they lower the landing craft into the sea from this converted passenger ferry, the Ulster Monarch, which is now serving as a assault landing craft vessel, a carrier. And in that very process of trying to put the first landing craft into the sea, some get dashed against the side, some get holed, some are unusable, men go overboard. It is horrendous. But here's the thing, and this goes to the heart of the SAS and epitomizes who they were and why they were so successful. So the landing crafts eventually get to shore. There's a terrible, terrible moment. I mean, it really is one of the most, you know, difficult moments I've ever, you know, had to write about in terms of what the SAS encountered. So they're steaming to shore through these terrible seas. They get into the lee of the cliffs and suddenly they see something in the water which is clearly man-made. They think it's an E-boat, a German E-boat. They believe they've been detected. It wasn't at all. It was the first of dozens of Horsa and Wacko Hadrian gliders, which were supposed to land further inland on Sicily, carrying British airborne troops to take the key bridges and roads to allow the invasion fleet to advance. But instead, because of the storm, 69 of them were blown into the sea, landed short. And on the wings and on the fuselage of the sinking aircraft are sat the paratroopers begging to be rescued. Now, second nightmare decision for Mayne, who's in the lead landing craft because he led from the front always, which is why his men loved him and would follow him anywhere. So Mayne then has to make a decision. Do I stop, try and haul some of these guys aboard and rescue them, in which case we will probably be too late to take out the shore guns before they can open up, or do I let them all drown? And so what he does is he stops, picks up one, puts him in the boat, gets some intelligence off him, and carries on all the rest of the airborne troops are basically left to drown. And hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them do drown. And worse still, those few gliders that do make it ashore on to Sicily, because the airborne planners have been so derelict in their duty, and there's no other word for it, they haven't even properly studied the air reconnaissance photos, which we know exist because you can see how the SAS studied them in great detail. It's in the book. Because they haven't studied them properly, the airborne planners, they haven't realized that Sicily is intensively cultivated and crisscrossed with dry stone walls. And those gliders that do make it ashore plow into the dry stone walls and everybody is killed, barring a few. So at that moment, Maine knows that they are very likely going to be the only elite force to make it ashore as the vanguard of the Husky Landing. So the stakes are even higher. But here's why the storm is a bonus. Because when they get to the shore and when they climb, scale those cliffs, and when they unleash their first rounds, which they do with the mortar, and when they start to tear into the first major gun emplacement, and bear in mind, Maine has said to his men, he gives a last-minute order, fixed bayonets, we will go in with moonlight glinting on cold steel, because he knows time is against them and he knows he has to strike the fear of God into the enemy. And as the Italian commander of that first battery, who has hundreds of men under his command, sees, realizes it's a land assault, it's not an airborne bombing raid, he radios his nearest German counterpart, not so very far away, and says, look, please send reinforcement. And the German officer says, this storm would make it impossible for anyone to land by air or sea. I'm not sending anyone. It's in your imagination. And because of that, no German troops are sent to reinforce that first battery. And Maine and his men storm in there. Intense fighting, but they take it. And very quickly, the Sergeant Bill Deakins, Maine's demolitions expert, gets his charges set around the guns and blows them to smithereens. It's an absolutely mind-blowingly incredible undertaking, bearing in mind everything they're up against.
And, I mean, some of it, as with all of these things, is down to an element of dumb luck. And some of it is down to but the majority of it is down to the fact that you have someone like Paddy Maine, who is so single-minded in achieving the objective. And as you say, you know, leading from the front. So the invasion force obviously landed, and Sicily and southern Italy fell very quickly. What was the role for the SAS in the rest of the campaign, all the way up the Italian peninsula?
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Well, first of all, they take that first gun battery, and then their orders rightly have given Maine basically total leeway to do whatever he sees as being necessary next. And having taken that first gun battery, there are three more further across the headland, the Cape of the Pig Snouts Peninsula, to translate the Italian name. And those guns start trying to fire on the invasion fleet. They're firing blind. They're having to fire across the headland, but it still, you know, poses significant danger. So Maine and his men then, as the sun rises, proceed to take three more gun batteries. And they see so many prisoners, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of prisoners, they can't even keep control of them all anymore. So they disarm them and send them all on their way. And during that process, the only real casualties they suffer are by deception and betrayal, because the Italians have this habit of pretending they've surrendered, putting up their hands, dropping their weapons. And then when Maine's men tried to take them captive, they would drop to the ground and behind them a machine gun would open fire. That happened several times.
Right.
So Maine and his men are very well aware that there are fake surrenders being carried out against them. And then 48, 72 hours after this incredible mission, they are going back to, returning to the Ulster Monarch, their landing, parent landing ship. And they're looking forward to a shower and a rest and some food because it's been pretty damn intense, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And as soon as they get back on the Ulster Monarch, they get new orders. The new orders are that the major German-Italian naval port of Augusta, just up the coast, which has E-boats, U-boats, seaplanes and a surface fleet and massive defences, they're told that there's a white flag of surrender flying above Augusta. Now, obviously, they don't believe it because of what they've suffered already, but they're given orders to go in and take the surrender of the port. So it's daylight, right, and they have to steam in on the Ulster Monarch and go in their landing craft on a daylight landing against a extremely heavily defended enemy port. Now, you can imagine the surrender is a lie, and they go in under intense fire. And once again, Paddy Maine is not only riding in a lead landing craft.
Right.
But he's the first out of that landing craft to storm the beaches. Right. And a lot of his men get gunned down in the very first moments of the landing. But Paddy Maine leads from the front as always. And they do take Augusta town. And then they are, and that in itself is that the seizing of the port is an incredible story. What an operation. And then they are used again as the Allies kind of leapfrog from there onto mainland Italy as the vanguard of the British forces, and they go in, they take another strategic German and Italian port town to enable the main army to move through.
Yeah.
So they are being used in these kind of missions, which are, I mean, bear in mind, Paddy Maine's got under his command at the start 287 men. Mm-hmm. They go in as a 287 strong force. I mean, in the desert, the most they'd ever deploy in is a few dozen men. These were small-scale hit-and-run raiding operations, shoot-and-scoot attacks,
yeah,
you know, generally using fast-moving jeeps. This is not what they have been, you know, formed to do at all. This is a completely different way of operating.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of it, you know, by late in the Italian campaign for the SAS, they have suffered horrendous casualties. And they are no longer a viable fighting force. That's why they returned to the UK and to regroup and recuperate for D-Day operations.
Sure. During that period of time, I think one of the things we sort of briefly touched on the last time we spoke was obviously as they were the kind of the almost like the progenitor of special forces, the US Rangers began to kind of emerge as a result of kind of training in Britain with the SAS and other the Marines and things like that. Did the US have a kind of an equivalent kind of vanguard during the Italian campaign, or was the SAS kind of unique among Allied forces at that moment?
Completely unique. I mean, you know, certainly during this period of the Italian campaign, so you're talking, you know, summer 1943 to the end of 1943. No, the Americans had nothing like it. And that's partly why you had the SAS going in as the tip of the spear on the Husky landings, which was a joint British and American operation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's actually not until, if you want to talk about the American equivalent force of the SAS, that they had nothing of the same ilk until they formed Delta Force, which,
right,
of course, exists to this day. And Delta Force wasn't formed until decades after the war. In fact, I know, and he's quite a good friend of mine, one of the founders of Delta Force, a chap called Bucky Burris, and he told me how to form Delta Force. They actually went and put themselves through SAS selection, him and one other guy, kind of in the 60s, to learn how we did it and then take it back to America and put together the Delta Force selection process as well. So, you know, at this time and for a long period thereafter, there was no other equivalent unit to the SAS and the SBS, the Special Boats Squadron Section Service, whatever you want to call it, had various names in America, in the American order of battle. And so they were doing these kind of operations, which, you know, no one else was taking on. That continued right the way through to the end of the war, right the way through to, you know, the spring of 1945. The SAS was serving right in the vanguard of Allied forces in that role.
And what of the, you know, the key kind of campaigns in Italy, the key sort of kind of battles, and the two that people will probably know will be the landings at Anzio and the enormous and very long battle at Monte Cassino.
Mm-hmm.
Were the SAS involved in either of those campaigns?
They were, but peripherally. Well, no, peripherally is not the right word. They were, but used in the role that the SAS should be used. I'll give you an example. So with the Anzio, a unit of SAS, about six strong, commanded by a chap called Witherington, with, his second in command's name escapes me, sorry, Paul Quentin Hughes.
Mm-hmm.
They parachute in, but they don't parachute in where the Anzio landing is taking place. They parachute in deep inland behind enemy lines, and they parachute in to attack an airbase where they know the Germans are flying their reconnaissance aircraft from, because if they can take those reconnaissance aircraft out, they can make sure that when the Anzio landing fleet comes in, there'll be no reconnaissance aircraft in the air that might spot the landings. And that's their mission. And it's a very successful, very costly mission. Those are the kind of things that the SAS are doing by that stage in the Italian campaign. They've kind of reverted back to what they were formed to do. And what Paddy Maine does with his 287 men during that July to November period, this is the crucial thing to understand. He wins the SAS a reprieve. Right. He once again proves what they can do. I mean, I'll give you an indication of how, you know, acclaimed their operations were. So their commander at the time was General Dempsey, who was a First World War veteran and a highly decorated, highly respected. And Dempsey says at the end of Paddy Maine's SAS campaign in Italy, a series of brilliant operations, brilliantly carried out. I have never had under my command a unit of the caliber and the discipline and capabilities that you have. I mean, you know, from a man like Dempsey, it's incredible praise. That's what they achieve. They win the SAS a reprieve, they win their survival, and they allow them, because of that, to recapture the original kind of operations that they used to do.
Right, right. And because, and it's interesting you come back to this idea of a reprieve. I think some people listening might find it strange, and I think this happens in military affairs more often than you think, might consider it strange that there would be figures in Whitehall and at the top of the army looking kind of suspiciously at things like the SAS and thinking and actively looking to disband them at the first available opportunity. And I suppose, you know, where we exist kind of now in being able to look back, we know what the SAS, what its use was. But at the time, what would have, you know, if you put yourself in the shoes of somebody who was an SAS skeptic, what would have their arguments actually been?
Their arguments were very simple. You know, these are people who generally have been schooled in First World War tactics, and they believed that, one, the SAS means of waging war was ungentlemanly. It wasn't what the British military should be doing. This wasn't what British officers should be engaged in. Hit and run attacks, shoot and scoop battles, hitting deep behind enemy lines. This wasn't gentlemanly conduct. That's the first thing. The second thing was, and this really went to the heart of it, that this unit had been formed in a way which undermined the very essence of the British military. Because, never forget, you know, when David Stirling, Paddy Maine and the rest formed the SAS, you know, they wrote out the key principles, and the key principles were an egalitarian unit,
right,
where rank does not matter, merit matters, merit above rank, and where no matter your rank, if you are part of an operation and the rest of the men on your patrol are killed or captured, you will go ahead and carry out the mission objective because you have the ability to do so. So these were self-starters, self-confident individuals, no matter what class or background or rank you had. And they were individuals who were deliberately chosen because they had unconventional mindsets. You had to think of ways to attack the enemy, which the enemy would never conceive of, because that was the very raison d'etre of the unit. And to do that, you had to be a maverick, unconventional thinker. You wore, certainly in North Africa, pretty much the battle dress and uniform you chose. You carried the weapon you chose. You didn't have to salute your officers. And the only form of discipline that mattered and had to be used was the threat of being returned to your unit, RTU, because when you were in that amazing elite brotherhood, the last thing anybody ever wanted was to be sent back to where they come from. All of that ran contrary and hit the very heart of the way the British military was used to doing things. And it's inconceivable, but so true, that the more successful they became, the more they became resented and undermined, because they were proving via their success that their critics were wrong.
It was about, I suppose, trying to introduce into the heart of Britain's kind of military establishment this kind of this thing that works on class, a completely different culture, something that's completely alien. If you think, you know, every organization from the British Army through to, you know, the NHS through to the BBC to whatever, any big group of people will acquire its own internal culture, its way of talking, thinking, and believing about certain things. Then when you go but in these exceptional circumstances of this war, which is completely unlike anything we've fought before. You know, all those ideas, by the way, are pretty redundant. We need to be doing these radically different things. Every so often, you're lucky in those circumstances when you have somebody influential, a Churchill or somebody like him, who goes, yeah, okay, cool, I'm listening. But I suspect in many instances, you have military innovators like Paddy Mayne who come along and their ideas kind of wither on the vine. We're going to their own more counterfactuals now. Fab. So, in the last few minutes that we've got, Damien, the book published at the moment, or are we waiting on? Is this week?
Yeah, it published on Thursday. Today's Friday, so yeah, just been out 24 hours. Yeah.
Okay, fabulous. So, guys, Forged in Hell by Damien Lewis. Make sure if you're picking one up, if you can do, please use your independent book retailer, because once those guys are gone, you will miss them like hell. You really will. And support that kind of ecosystem of small independent book retailers if you can, please. Damien, we'll finish there. Thank you so much. And I eagerly anticipate the next time you pop into to talk to us about the SAS again. But it's been a pleasure once again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much.
All right. Take good care.
Bye-bye.